enforcers, Gordon. I sell women's shoes.
And the Stallion.
Stallion, baby! I am not what you would call a handsome man.
I'll kick you in the nuts and you'll smile at me and like it.
Oh, nice!
Welcome to another edition of the All Night Long Wrestling Podcast. We are your host. I am the Enforcer. He is the Stallion. And we are back for yet another week, Val. Welcome back.
I can't believe it either.
Ratings are through the roof. People are clamoring for some more All Night Long Wrestling Podcast. And we are here to give back to those that give to us. I'm just going to sit there and ask.
Who are those people?
I'm wondering the same thing. But anyway, listen, more importantly, we got a huge show this week, better than we have any right in having. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We're going to have some recap of this weekend's big events, NXT TakeOver Brooklyn 3 and WWE's SummerSlam. And also, we are very privileged to have former the guy's been everywhere. Former WWE superstar, former TNA superstar, current New Japan Pro Wrestling superstar, Lance Archer, also known as Lance Hoyt, back in Impact Wrestling on our show later on today. So I'm thrilled. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's very exciting when we have guests on the show.
I feel like the guests like us more than our listeners do.
Yeah, I think that there's merit in that statement for sure. So I am.
I mean, we've had on our show, in a very short amount of time, All Ego, Ethan Page, Keith Lee, Casey Carlisle, Beer City Bruiser,
SoCal Val. There is another one. Thunder Rosa was on
our show. I mean, these are like big name people listening to us. And why are they coming on our show?
I don't know. I mean, there's not a whole lot of money being exchanged. So it's very nice of them to do that.
Yeah, and we sincerely appreciate it. Give it back to the people that give. So let's quickly get into it. We have about, I would say, about 20 minutes before we hope to hear from Lance Archer. So let's hop right into NXT. NXT Brooklyn. I think everybody kind of had some hopes for this show, high hopes especially. We'll start off at the top. The first match of the night was Johnny Gargano against Andrade Cien Almas. Run that back. Who won that match?
Andrade Cien Almas won the match.
That's what I thought. We're looking at some slunker, you know, I thought I was crazy.
If you're looking at the Wikipedia right now for TakeOver Brooklyn 3, all of the match results are reversed. So it's a good thing that we've noticed this, because if you look at Wikipedia right now, it shows that the winners were actually the losers in the match. So
somebody's a real dick.
Yeah, cheeseburger. Yeah. Dick cheeseburger.
Whatever the kids say. We should get cheeseburger on the show. Anyway, let's get back to the recap here. I think you and I were split on this one. I feel like Johnny Gargano needed a win, and you said Almas was going to win, and you were right. However, Zelina Vega did not have as much of a role in this match as you had anticipated.
I think she played a part in the finish. So she threw what was a DIY T-shirt at Johnny Gargano.
That
was her.
Yep. Damn it, I suck. I remember he had the shirt and he looked at it.
Yeah, I didn't really get picked up on camera. I think that it was a DIY shirt, but I guess just the color of it, whatever it was. So they had a really good match going, though, for a while, and that was towards the end. She threw the shirt at Gargano's face. It distracted him, and then Almas ended up hitting his finisher and getting the win.
Really good match, really good fast pace, super-duper strong opener. And Johnny Gargano got himself into some insane shape. I got to give him that credit. He's a great looking guy. He's got life by the tail right now. He's married. Is he married to Candice LeRae?
I believe they are married.
They are married, man. He's out there, Johnny Wrestling, man. He's all American. He's like Johnny Manziel. Johnny Manziel was good at anything. Yeah. Okay. Next was Sanity. Interesting. I thought it was going to be Alexander Wolfe and Killian Dane. However, it turned out to be Alexander Wolfe and Eric Young taking on the Authors of Pain. This was a fantastic match. Three very big men and EY, who was no small man. And these guys, man, they put on one hell of a show. They told a great story. I love the interference from Nikki Cross, that one spot where the Authors of Pain were about to suplex powerbomb EY, and then Nikki Cross held his leg so they couldn't. I think Akam wound up powerbombing Razor. And then for, I would say the last 6 minutes were just a crazy sprint. I thought it was a great match.
Yeah, it was much better than certainly I expected it to be. I don't know if everyone else's expectations were the same or not, but I wasn't expecting a whole lot out of this match. Both teams were kind of booked as, you know, heel teams, or they have been booked that way since they've been in NXT. But the crowd definitely took to Sanity, I think, and them winning the titles was something I certainly wasn't expecting, but it was definitely a very good match and exceeded the expectations that I had for it.
I'm a huge mark for the Alexander Wolf, by the way. That dude, I think he really shined in this match. But I will tell you, you and I watched this together the other night, and right around the end of the match, EY gets the pin on the jumping blockbuster back suplex combo. They replayed the highlights, and I sat on the edge of my seat with bated breath, as they say. And sure enough, buddy, I jumped around like a young Everlast in the House of Pain video once the two-man smash machine, the best team on God's green, Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish, formerly, possibly, futurely known as Red Dragon, hit the ring and decimated everybody. They threw the Authors of Pain into the Killian Dane went into the steps. The Authors of Pain got tossed into the ring post. Alexander Wolf got hit with it was a kind of a high low. I don't think I've ever seen him do that before. It was Bobby Fish's fish hook with a spinning back kick from Kyle O'Reilly and chasing the dragon on Eric Young. And the crowd went nuts, buddy. Don't tell me that the WWE can't put on a show in a big arena with NXT, because NXT was three times as loud as SummerSlam, as SmackDown, and as Raw for professional wrestling, not for some BS spots or not for some stupid gimmick actor or something like that. Four great wrestling matches, the Barclays Center blew the roof off.
They did. It's true. I don't know whether it's a combination of different things, perhaps better booked storylines and more entertaining wrestlers in ring, or how the matches are being laid out. Maybe different set of fans that are going to NXT versus maybe some of the main roster stuff, or whatever the shorter show versus a longer show, whatever the reasons are, that comes off as a very hot crowd for these shows, the NXT shows, regardless of really where they are, but Brooklyn especially, and the matches that get put on. And I'll wait till we're done to the recap, but I was able to read through all of the King David Meltzer ratings for these matches, as in addition to the SummerSlam ones, and I'll read those out.
Oh, I'm on the edge of my seat.
I'll read those
out
to you after we finish the recap here. But all the matches come off really, really well in ring and with the crowd and the atmosphere and all that stuff. So, good on them for doing it. These are the shows I look forward to the most in terms of when, pay per view or major events. And, they've consistently done a good job, and this. The debut of Red Dragon as a team.
Awesome. It was awesome.
It was well done. They came out and basically laid waste to everybody and, put themselves right in the mix for the tag titles. And I believe we're taping this on a Thursday. So I think they're doing NXT tapings for TV tonight.
They did, yeah.
So we'll see what the next steps are for them and another gentleman that we'll start talking about in a few minutes here as we kind of finish up the NXT recap.
Percy Watson?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, good.
The one.
Next match was Aleister Black.
Kwee-wee.
No. Wow. No. Next match was Aleister Black taking on Hideo Itami. Aleister Black got the superstar entrance of the Code Orange and Incendiary vocalist to do his theme song. I thought it was awesome. Really set the tone. And these guys had a really good match. It looks like at some point Aleister Black broke his nose. Am I wrong?
It looked that way.
Yeah.
He was busted and his nose looked a little weird.
Yeah. So. I thought it was another strong match from them. But I'll tell you, for anybody listening, about 15 seconds before the finish of the match, you looked at me and you go, it's going to be one of those things where he takes a beating and then he has a spinning kick out of nowhere. And surely, like, by the end, you're finishing that sentence, he had hit the, what does he call it? I'm sorry.
Black Mass.
Black Mass, and that was it. But I thought it was a good match. I would say Aleister Black did not get in that much offense, though. I think it was mostly Atomic.
It was definitely a longer match than Black has been working. I mean, I know he worked a little bit longer of a match with Hero when he, or excuse me, Cassius Ohno. Yeah.
Oh, no.
And he had matches with Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly individually that lasted maybe around 10 minutes that were kind of similar. But this was probably one of his longer matches and more competitive matches going with Atomi and them doing a lot of their strikes or kickboxing type things that are happening in that match. So, but, you know, again, it was a good match, I thought. And you know, Black winning was, I think, something we all expected to happen, but it's the right thing because he's kind of getting the big push down there. He hasn't been defeated yet.
Yep, another strong match. Ember Moon versus Asuka for the NXT Women's title. I think we both thought Ember Moon was going to take the title here. I kind of thought you're going to see Asuka on Sunday night at SummerSlam. No, apparently you cannot beat Asuka. It's like playing Goro in Mortal Kombat, the difficulty all the way
so
up.
So frustrating.
Oh, dude, I'm telling you, jump kick, get back, freeze, jump kick. It took me like hours and hours and hours. You're not going to beat Asuka. Ember Moon hit her with everything but the kitchen sink, including the lunar eclipse, solar eclipse, black eclipse, white.
The eclipse, I believe is what it's called.
It's not like the lunar eclipse? Or the...
I don't think so. I'll check on that for you.
Yeah, can we Google Ember Moon finisher? We're just going to... It is the eclipse. Okay.
Oh, wow.
On the Independence, it was apparently called the O-Face. Anybody who saw Office Space,
that one coming.
It took a turn to negative town. I don't think Asuka's going to lose in NXT. There's nobody left for her to beat unless it's the winner of the Mae Young Classic, who I do not know who that's going to be. I'm trying to keep it that way because I don't know the results of anything.
Right. And they taped up to the finals, right? So they have the finals set, but obviously nothing's aired yet on the network. They're supposed to start releasing some of the episodes on the 28th, which is this coming Monday. And I think that's the only real option at this point that I could see is the winner of that tournament getting a shot at Asuka and then potentially beating her before she maybe moves on to a main roster spot. I don't know. I like Ember Moon. I thought they've had two good matches together on these takeover specials. I wouldn't have had any issue if Ember Moon won, but to go back to it a third time, I think might be tough from a storyline perspective. Not that they just can't do whatever they want anyway, but
sure, I'm sure they will. Tough, yeah. For me, I think the person to beat Asuka should be Nikki Cross. I think she's very over with the crowd. She's a very strong worker. She's great in the ring. And people really like her. I think that's something they can get behind, and you could even turn Asuka heel and have Nikki Cross face, because I believe they're kind of eyeing Sanity as a face team now. That's the way it seemed, at least when Red Dragon came in and beat the tar out of them on Saturday. So the main event of the night, Drew McIntyre versus champion, the glorious one, Bobby Roode. Not to be negative, but for me, I thought this was probably the weakest match of the night. I feel like it was very slow and longer than it really needed to be. I like both these guys individually, but Bobby Roode his matches to me have been somewhat underwhelming in NXT. I'm a big fan of the gimmick. Everybody loves the gimmick, but to me, his matches just they've been missing something. McIntyre, I do like him a lot. I'm a big fan of his work, and I think putting the title on him was the right move, especially considering what happened afterwards and following. And why don't you tell us what happened?
Yeah. So they had their match, and McIntyre ended up winning the title, which I think both of us thought it was probably too early for that to happen, but it did happen. And obviously, and again, everyone who's listening to this on Thursday, and no spoilers at this point because everything's happened already, but Bob Roode has moved to SmackDown.
Robert Roode. It's Bob Fish.
Excuse me. Robert Roode.
Yeah.
Has moved over to SmackDown. I think he's still going to have a match in NXT with Roderick Strong, but he's moved up to the main roster now. So after this show.
I thought they said whoever the champion was.
I thought it was just Roddy got a match with Bobby Roode, regardless of whether it was.
Interesting.
Or
okay.
Not. So
I could be wrong.
We'll see, I guess, after the tapings tonight, what they play out. But anyway, so McIntyre won. And then as he was quote unquote celebrating, they even threw up the copyright graphic on the bottom.
Get me every time with that.
And then all of a sudden, Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish had appeared. on the ring apron and kind of distracted McIntyre. And as that was happening, you heard kind of a roar developing in the crowd in Brooklyn. And sure enough, the long rumored debut of Adam Cole took place, and he ran in and attacked Drew McIntyre with the help of Fish and O'Reilly. They held him up for Cole, and Cole superkicked them and basically superkicked McIntyre, and basically they stood over him as the show went off the air, essentially forming a stable between the three of them, and with Cole looking to go after the NXT title pretty much right away.
Were you excited to see Adam Cole? I think that would be an understatement.
I was excited. I jumped up and down, I believe.
I think we both did. I think you're exactly right. Now, my only problem is it me or did Morrow immediately know that was Adam Cole? Like,
did you listen to the Taz show on Sunday or anything like that? Because someone called up on the Taz show once. I was driving home Sunday night after SummerSlam.
Okay.
Someone called into the Taz show and asked that exact question, basically saying that when Cole ran in, Morrow identified him immediately before anybody else really could even see that it was him, because he ran in, you only saw him from behind,
right?
And I see like his hair as he was punching away at McIntyre, and it was Taz actually said that it was a mistake, so essentially from Morrow, to, you know, that he did that, he shouldn't have identified him right away, made him come off as maybe being smarter than the fans in some sense.
I actually read it on one of the, not a dirt cheap, one of the Facebook groups. So then I went back and I rewatched the match, and he actually calls out Adam Cole like before he even gets in the ring. I mean, to me, like, I think you and I knew what was going to happen. So, but you know, to somebody else, you know, you'd have to, but then not even a split second after that, you have, you know, Nigel saying the same thing. So I guess that air of invincibility is gone, like question, if you will. But now, I mean, the landscape of NXT has changed completely. I mean, and I think it's for the better, because NXT, I know I haven't watched it very much recently. I think, you know, I catch up as much as I can, but it's not something I can't, you know, that I'm going to stay home on a Wednesday night to watch, and I have to be there for it. Now, I'm going to be watching NXT. Now, everything has kind of changed. You have three of my favorite wrestlers in the entire world, you know, actually four if you include Broderick Strong, all under one banner, getting 1 hour a week. I am 100% on board.
Yeah, it's hard not to be if you're someone who's followed those guys in Ring of Honor and elsewhere. I think we've been following them probably for about 4 years or so on the indies, when we started to kind of really get focused on some of those companies and shows. So those are guys that we've watched for a long time. We've seen them wrestle in person several times. We've met them, you know, at autograph signings and take pictures with them and stuff like that. So it's, you know, guys that you do that with, I think you kind of, you know,
when they recognize you, it's like,
yeah,
you know,
you're kind of along for the ride with these guys as they're hitting their peak and their prime of their careers. Now that they make it to this level, and then not only to make it to NXT, but to have the impact that they did on, you know, O'Reilly and Fish had one match each in NXT just kind of to get them on the program. But this was essentially their debut as a team, and then Cole's debut at, you know, overall. So for them to come in at pretty much right at the main event level, to see them achieve that success right away is pretty cool. You know, for all the years we've seen them some going. And we know they're obviously really talented and hardworking guys. And, you know, I like NXT probably more than any other show that I watch at this point, or in company. So I have faith that they'll be able to book them in a manner that keeps them interesting and strong before, you know, with some storylines over the next year or so. I think that'll be cool to watch. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's kind of interesting how, you know, the most over thing right now on NXT is just superstars that the WWE has taken from somewhere else, and they haven't been able to really build anybody up in NXT. I mean, when you look at the entire NXT roster right now, who is the homegrown talent in NXT that's over with the crowd?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, I guess. If you look at like teams, like Authors of Pain, I think is a homegrown team. I don't know else they've done.
I'll give you the AOP.
I don't know how you classify McIntyre, because he was in their system. I don't know all of his history before. You know, he was first when he came to the main roster on SmackDown. I don't know if he's got a lot of background, but he was a guy that was there before. Outside of that, I think you've got guys that have come in from, you know, TNA and ROH, like Rude and Eric Young and
Gargano, from Evolve, right?
Now you've got Cole, O'Reilly, Fish, the other guys that they've had that have kind of come through there. The Revival, I think, obviously, I'm sure they've had some indie work, but they weren't really like famous, I think, before they came up. So, it's a big mix, but I think it's primarily more guys that they've brought in from the outside that kind of have some name value.
Well, but it does make for a very intriguing show. And speaking of intriguing, I would like to welcome into the All Night Long Wrestling Podcast, Lance Archer. Welcome to the show, sir.
What's up, man?
Not much, man. We really appreciate you coming on. And I just want to say, we're talking former NWA TNA World Tag Team Champion, New Japan Pro Wrestling IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team Champion, G1 Tag League winner, Pro Wrestling NOAH Tag Team Champion. What in the business? Where haven't you been?
Well, I've been fired from a lot of places, so I've had opportunities to go into a lot of different companies. I've been lucky and blessed, man, in this crazy business of professional wrestling. 17 years, had some amazing opportunities with TNA back when TNA first was really getting going and getting started from, just the early Nashville days and then on into the first Impact stuff that we were doing out of Orlando and all the first pay-per-views and all the first that TNA was producing when the company was still brand new, to my short time in WWE, my many different times to Japan. I was going to Japan before I even did WWE. Did some independent stuff in Japan, did a tour with All Japan, and then I did my time with WWE for those 2 years. And then, like you said, I signed on with New Japan Pro Wrestling back in 2011 and have been in Japan ever since. And it's been an amazingly cool, fun ride, and it's about to get going here again because I've been on about a six-month hiatus from an injury and getting ready to start that first tour back with New Japan here in September.
Absolutely. And before, we touch on, I want to talk about the early stuff you had at TNA, but I know you spoke about the injury. It was the herniated disc surgery. I think it was Killer Reed Squad versus Makabe and Homa and Ishii and Yano. And that's, that was a feud that you had going on for a long time with Makabe. Mm-hmm. Tell me what happened, how that injury happened. Was it something that you felt during the match, or was it something that you've been dealing with and just kind of came to a head?
Yeah, basically that's what it was. I'd been dealing with a sciatic issue, which anybody that's ever had sciatic issues knows, it comes and it goes as far as the severity. In wrestling, I don't think anybody's ever 100% at any given time. And I was just working through the goods and bads and doing what I could when it was bad and then doing more, obviously, when it was good. And actually, that match you're speaking of in Sapporo on February 5th, I was really good. I was ready to go. I was barely feeling anything, as far as any kind of pain or discomfort or anything. And we had the match and nothing specific happened in the match. It was just something must have happened either in that match or during the run-in or something like that, because every day following that, it just got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse to the point where ultimately, I got it evaluated in Japan and then they tried to give me a few days off hoping it would get better. And it just got worse and worse and worse to the point where they had to check me in the hospital and basically did kind of an emergency surgery because on the Saturday, which was February 11th, which was the same day that the rest of the guys were in Osaka, Japan, which was the end of the tour, and I was supposed to be a part of that, I was having a surgery, which the doctors moved everything up and called some anesthesiologist in for me and for that specific purpose. And it was a blessing, man. I say, and I have faith that God took care of me exactly where he needed me to be taken care of. He knocked me on my butt exactly when I need to be knocked on my butt and then brought everything into play exactly how it should have been.
That's a glass half full approach, man. I'm glad to hear that you recovered so well from it. I deal with it myself. And I got to ask you, going over to Japan, how tough is that plane ride on you? I can't imagine that being very good for the back either.
I've just been doing it for so many years. It's one of those things, like the long plane rides don't bother me as much because the planes are bigger. I have good status with Delta and the New Japan flies me over on Delta every time. So I get to pick and choose my seats. So I get to pick and choose kind of, it's coach. I don't get any business class seats unless I get very lucky, but I'd get to choose, you know, the economy comforts, or I get to choose the exit row, which has nothing in front of me. Like I said, there's more space. I can get up and move around, walk around, stretch up and whatnot. The smaller planes, the little regional jets and, you know, the state bouncers, they're the worst ones because they're so small and compact and you can't really get up and move and do anything.
Well, kudos to New Japan for taking care of you, man. That's a long flight. So I give you credit for that. So you spoke about your time in TNA. I mean, between Hoytomania, which ran wild, which I thought was awesome, and that's a testament to you being able to get that over. I thought that was one of the coolest things. The crowd really ate that up. How did that come about?
That was really on the fans, man. You know, like I said, everything was very early on in the TNA days. And, you know, we definitely had a very hardcore TNA fan base, people that loved TNA, that came to TNA, especially when we came into Orlando. You know, and it was really their creation. I just was doing my part and trying to wrestle my heart out like I always did. And for whatever reason, I would like to say a large group of people decided that they liked me. You know, they would make signs and stuff to the point where they would have to ask them to put them down because, you know, it's blocking people's view. And then they went and made their own shirts. There was a rumor backstage that I was taking these people out to eat at the Orlando Ale House, which was a place where everybody would go eat afterwards. And it's like, I don't know if anybody realized the paycheck I was receiving. There was no way I was catering, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 plus people just so they would cheer for me, you know, in their named Hoytomania section, you know. So it was really their creation. A guy who actually became a good friend of mine, his name's Michael Kerrigan. He lives out in Orlando still. I'm really close with him and his family, and he kind of spearheaded that. And, you know, good man, good person, good family, and it's kind of funny and cool. Like I said, they took it upon themselves and created their own thing, and I just had fun with it and got to feed off the energy for a while.
That's a great story. And so, breaking news: you were not behind the Hoytomania. I want everybody to know that now.
No, not you. Hulkamania got paid well by TNA, not Hoytomania.
Now, like you said, the early days of, you know, of TNA, I mean, I'm still a fan of, you know, Impact Wrestling right now. I'm sorry, GFW. Mm-hmm. I don't know whatever it is named now. But,
it's
you know,
still Impact Wrestling.
Yeah, it's Impact Wrestling according to my TV guide, but then the GFW titles, I don't know. But, you know, they had like the weekly pay-per-views, and the crowd back mm-hmm. then, I think, was equally as loud as almost the Barclays Center was last weekend, because that diehard fan base, it really did remind me of, you know, the old school ECW arena or the Madhouse of Extreme in Queens. It was that, you know, that tight-knit bond where I think everybody in the arena wanted that company to succeed.
Yeah, you know, and the weekly pay-per-views you're talking about, those were in Nashville. So the Asylum, as they dubbed it, you know, was a very, very small, intimate arena. You know, it fit, I don't know, anywhere from 700 to 1,000 people, I think, depending on how many people just chose to pack in there and whatnot. And, you know, it was a fun environment. Like you said, they were really into it, and they were really behind it. And, you know, like I said, it's very niche, and it was their own. You know, I think they were pretty sad to see us leave, you know, but the company was in a growth period when we left Nashville and went just Orlando for the Impact stuff.
After Hoytomania, you had one of the, I would say, the coolest teams that was the Rock and Rave Infection. Is that something that, you know, again, is that organic, or how did that one come about?
Oh, you know, I mean, everything in this business happens in different ways, I guess. You know, again, I've been with the company for several years at this point. Had wrestled under two different names. Dallas was my first name when I started at TNA, and then Dusty Rhodes was the one who had me start working under my real name, Lance Hoyt. You know, the Rock and Rave Infection thing came about basically. Vince Russo, who was one of the bookers at the time, he was a big fan of Jimmy Rave and wanted to bring Jimmy into the company. And then he talked to me already and said that he wanted us to be a tag team. I was like, that's cool. I don't know Jimmy at all at the time. You know, Jimmy was doing his thing, or had been doing his thing at Ring of Honor back in the day when he'd get toilet paper thrown into the ring at him, which I thought was one of the most unique, cool things that anybody's ever had done to them in a wrestling venue. Anyway, so they put us together. We actually coined the name Rock and Rave Infection prior to us taking on the true persona that it became. And then, you know, basically, like, we all showed up for TV one day because I'd run a storyline with Christy Hemme where, you know, I was secretly on her side and we were dating and helped her turn against the Voodoo Kin Mafia. And then we came together as a couple. Then Jimmy showed up and we were a tag team with her as our manager. But then we showed up for TV one day, basically, and the story I like to tell is that, you know, Disco Inferno, who's one of the backstage agents at the time, comes up to us, you know, very wide-eyed and excited, and he's like, hey, you guys here? And we're like, no, what, Disco? And he's like, oh, so you guys have this new gimmick. And we're like, okay, what is it? And he goes, okay, so you know the game Guitar Hero? And all of us just went, yeah. I was like, I've never played the game before in my life at that point. And he goes, okay, so the deal is you guys all think you're rock stars, but you only play Guitar Hero. And we were just like, oh my goodness. You know, we thought it was kind of a kiss of death, like somebody was trying to make fun of us or whatever. And who knows, maybe somebody was to whatever degree. But we said, can we do whatever we want with this? We don't have to be what we've been. Can we kind of envision ourselves and make it our own? And they were like, oh yeah, absolutely. You know, and that week that we were there, I think we had 3 Impact tapings over the 2 days. So we were on all 3 tapings. We had matches, I think, on all 3. We had live microphone time. We had backstage interview stuff and whatnot. So it was the most that they'd ever done with us. So they were putting us on the map with it, you know, and it was kind of up to us to do our own thing. And I think that's what we did. So, you know, ultimately, we weren't fully prepared during that set of tapings, but we all had an envisionment and what it ultimately became. You know, I took on the Slash-esque look with the torn and tattered jeans and the top hat, and, you know, I had cigarettes even though I didn't really smoke. And, you know, Jimmy was kind of the glam rock with the flashy tights and the holy see-through shirt that actually Christian gave to him, which is a cool story in its own. And then Christy Hemme, who's, you know, she's a hot rock star babe that can actually sing, but pretended to sing badly in front of the people, which I thought was always funny. And, you know, Jimmy could never remember the city we were in, which was always Orlando, but he always said some other city. You know, and then I would just ask them for the most ridiculous things, you know, ham sandwich and a box of M&Ms or something like that, or a fifth of whiskey. And, you know, it was just, we just tried to have fun with it. And I think that translated to the people and the fans, because it's amazing that even today, like, people go, oh yeah, you were in that rock and rave thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. And it was a fairly short-lived gimmick. We never held championships with it. You know, we thought we could have. We thought they could have done a lot more with it than they did. But, you know, we were a part of the tag team situation, wrestling LAX and Motor City Machine Guns on several different occasions back then, and having really good matches. In fact, I think it was the Destination X. We were the opening match, a 3-way opening tag match. Again, LAX, Motor City Machine Guns, and us. And I don't know if anybody thought it was going to be much, and they just kind of threw us together and out there because we had been working together, and we got a lot of backstage praise as to doing really well and, you know, showing out and opening the pay-per-view in a very good way. And they were, it was funny because it was like they were surprised that it was as good as it was. And we're all kind of like, well, we've been working together. We all believe in ourselves. So why wouldn't it be any good? And it was a cool situation, a cool moment, but ultimately, it didn't pan out or go any further than kind of what people saw, you know, and that's a disappointment, I think, to a lot of people.
I think that's what's so impressive, is to be able to take something that, you know, you, like you guys said, you saw and you kind of thought it was like the kiss of death, and to be able to believe in it so much and make it your own. And for anybody who's not familiar with the Rock and Rave Infection, I just went back about a week ago and I was watching some of this stuff on YouTube, and that whole era has staying power. It is still as funny and as awesome today. So YouTube, Rock and Rave Infection, there are plenty of great matches on there and some really awesome segments. After TNA, you had a stay over in the new ECW, WWF or WWE's ECW. Were you a fan of the original ECW? Is that something you were familiar with?
See, I not that I wasn't a fan, I just didn't get to watch it. You know, when I started watching wrestling in my small town in Texas, the only thing I got to see on TV early on was WCW Nitro. TNT was the only thing that I had. I didn't get to watch when, you know, back in the day when it was still WWF. I certainly didn't have TNN to watch ECW when it actually came on TV. So I didn't even know ECW existed till I got into the business. And even then, I really didn't see it myself. So to say I was an original fan, no, I wasn't, because I wasn't watching it when it was originally on. I've become friends with a lot of the original ECW guys and how good of people they are and wrestlers and everything else. So I'm a fan of the guys that came out of there more so than the product itself, because I didn't get to watch it a lot. And then for my chance to be a part of WWE's ECW, You know, it was a great place. I think, you know, it was kind of a precursor to what NXT is now. Only it was done on the road and it was under the ECW banner, which was something that, you know, had its own life back in the day. And now it was under WWE's umbrella and how they were operating it. But, you know, you think of back then, a lot of the stars that became some of the biggest stars for them. I mean, obviously CM Punk started on their ECW product. I know CM Punk had his following from his independent days, Ring of Honor, even his short stuff in TNA. But he made his name for the WWE product starting on their ECW stuff. Sheamus started on their ECW. Kofi Kingston started on their ECW. Matt Sydal, you know, Evan Bourne, he started on their ECW product. I'm sure there's people that I'm leaving out here, but there's several guys that started on their ECW product and it was their precursor to moving up onto the main product. Bobby Lashley, another guy that started on their ECW product. You know, so it was a good stepping stone for guys like myself. You know, I'd been in their developmental system for about 6 months prior, working in FCW and training and doing all that stuff, and then got my opportunity to be brought up on ECW. So it was a really cool experience, and it was a good thing because ECW kind of was its own element. So I had a chance to have my own stories and build my own character to a degree. Unfortunately, ECW quit existing about 4 months after I started. I think if it had lasted longer and given myself and the Dude Busters and several talents like that that started around that same time, if it had lasted longer, it would have given all of us a chance to grow and become more familiar within the WWE universe and have a better opportunity in the future.
How big of a difference was there in the atmosphere between TNA and the WWE ECW at that time? Was that like a big culture shock when you made a change?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very different, WWE was a very different company when I was a part of it, 2009, 2010, as comparison to what it is now. I think specifically, it was one of those companies, like it was very controlled and very regimented. I felt like a lot of guys were on eggshells. You know, WWE had its main superstars, so it wasn't necessarily actively trying to build new superstars. You know, it had its mainstay guys. You know, Taker was still very active. Shawn Michaels was still active. You know, Flair had just recently stepped away and things like that, but they still had Kane. They still had Big Show. They still had, you know, obviously John Cena, you know, and a lot of these big name main stars that were on a full-time active roster. So for me and guys like that who were coming up, it was a very slow process for some of us. And you know, also this was at a time when Linda McMahon was trying to get into the Senate. So the company was really, really watching their P's and Q's as far as the product that was put on TV, because ultimately, you know, the world likes to look at professional wrestling in some kind of negative way. And with what she was trying to accomplish into the Senate, ultimately anybody that's running against her is going to try to use pro wrestling against her, you know, even though it has nothing, one has nothing to do with the other, but because she's a part of that with her family. So the company was very regimented. You know, there was a time when no blood was allowed to be seen on TV at all. Like they would absolutely stop everything. You know, you could be mid match, you know, full steam ahead. Everything's running on, you know, all six cylinders. You know, people are into it. Everything's just perfect. And if somebody's, you know, a trickle of blood came down off somebody's head or out of their nose or anything like that, you know, it would be full stoppage. They would, the referee would stop you. The referee would send whoever wasn't bleeding off to one corner. You know, it happened to me and Shelton Benjamin. We had a match on ECW and it was actually no rules match or whatever. I can't remember what it was called anyway, but basically, you know, we were having the match, headbanger off the announce table. We got back in the ring and all of a sudden he hit it kind of hard. He was bleeding and all of a sudden they stopped everything, just dead stop. Like referees like, hey, stop, go to that corner. You know, Shelton over here, you know, called the doctor into the ring. Doctor actually rolled to my feet, looked at me and I went, I'm not bleeding. So he went to check on Shelton and make sure he was okay. And then, you know, then once they determined everything was okay and they could get the blood stopped, they let us continue on with our match. You know, and like I said, at that time, you know, they would even do that on live events, things that weren't televised. You know, Tyson Kidd and I were into a moment where something like that happened. You know, it's a very physical business, and sometimes bleeding happens, and his nose got popped and it started bleeding, and they just dead stopped everything, you know. And I think they've laxed on that a little bit to a degree now, you know, knowing and recognizing that it's a physical sport, it's a physical business. You know, and if it happens, it happens. Obviously, if it's something severe, they might stop and make sure the person's okay. But if it's something simple, they're probably going to let it go on, especially if the athlete says that they're fine. So it was a very controlled and regimented environment. And I think that was the biggest difference coming from the TNA product into the WWE product. You're going from a company that is growing and trying to find itself still. You know, it's a little more freedom with the guys because they want them to find themselves, into a company that's very established, that is an entertainment company. So I'm coming from a pro wrestling company to an entertainment company with two very different mindsets on how they want their superstars and athletes to be viewed, you know. So it definitely was a transition. But like I said, I spent my time down in FCW for about 6 months, so it kind of helped that transition. If I'd have just gone directly from TNA onto WWE television, I think it would have been a bigger jolt to my system. But being a part of their system within FCW, kind of learning and understanding how they operated, it helped that transition make it a little more smooth.
It's funny you mentioned like all the blood and guts, and you go from something that was very, I don't want to say watered down, but there was a lot of reins on him. And then you go to join with who I think is the scariest human being walking the planet, no matter the size, the age, and that's Minoru Suzuki and Suzuki Gunn. So
yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, that's definitely, you know, literally changing of the world. How did you become a part of Suzuki Gunn? And is that something that was, you know, did you have your sights set on New Japan, or did it just a phone ring one day and that was the next logical step?
Okay, first off, I want to, and I do this with everybody because I made the exact same mistake when I first started saying it. It's Suzuki Goon, not Suzuki Gunn. I know it's spelled G-U-N like gun, like we pronounce, but it's actually Goon, and Goon translates to army. So that's what it means, Suzuki's army.
I appreciate that. I've been saying it wrong for probably 7 years now, and nobody corrected me. So thank you very much.
Suzuki himself corrected me after a promo post-match one time. It literally, like, we got done with the match. After we got done with the match, we did our promo backstage like we always do. We get to the locker room and goes, oh, very good match. Goon, not gun. Goon, like army. I went, oh, okay. And he goes, okay, good. So it was, anyway, again, I made the same mistake everybody does because we're English and we see G-U-N, we say gun. Anyway, you know, funnily enough, my career in Japan in some form or manner has always kind of been tied to Minoru Suzuki. Like I said, back in 2007, I went over to Japan and worked for a small independent company. It was called Makahan. It turned into Vader Time Wrestling. My very first match ever in Japan was a tag match. I don't even remember who my partner was, and I have no clue. I don't remember who Suzuki's partner was, but it was me and my partner against Suzuki and somebody else. To the point where, like, you know, I had no idea who Suzuki-san was. I didn't know, you know, his background. I didn't know the lore. I didn't know the character. I didn't know anything about him. I just knew I was having a match. I was the guy from the States and TNA that they'd brought in, whatever. So we had this match. It was fine, whatever. He and I had very little interaction during the match, but it was just one of those things, like, it's kind of funny because that was my very first match ever in Japan. To the point where I worked All Japan in 2009, right before I actually signed on with WWE. And he was actually the Triple Crown champion at that time back then. I don't think we ever had any matches while I was there, but he's the Triple Crown champion of All Japan Pro Wrestling at the time back in 2009. And I was in the company working with them. And then ultimately, you're asking how I got into New Japan. 2009, I was in All Japan. I did a tour. They actually asked me to come back. I said, yeah, absolutely. But then very quickly, because while I was in Japan, still on that tour with All Japan, I had a conversation with TNA. My time with TNA was ending. As soon as my time with TNA was ending, I had somebody reach out to WWE, which they were interested. I literally filmed my last TNA thing because we did the Off the Wagon Challenge like on a Monday. My contract was null and void on Wednesday. And then I was in Tampa on Thursday, basically doing a tryout, and then was offered a contract like a week after that. So that all happened very quickly. So I never got a chance to go back to Japan. So fast forward to when my time with WWE was ending, I still wanted to wrestle. I didn't know where I was going to go, what was going to happen. I was obviously putting feelers out. I reached out to All Japan. We actually came to an agreement. I was supposed to go back to All Japan in late February of 2011. And they backed out, you know, and it was just kind of like, okay, I don't know what's going on here. Their excuse was they weren't going to bring as many guys in to save money, whatever. So I asked the person that I was dealing with in Japan if they would even reach out to New Japan for me. And they did. They basically let New Japan know that I was interested, that I was a big American, and I just finished WWE and so on and so forth. And New Japan, I don't think, knew anything about me other than the fact that they told them that I was this big gaijin and I just finished WWE. And at this time, you know, with New Japan, there weren't a lot of foreigners. Giant Bernard, who, you know, was A-trained before, became Lord Tenzai, and is now the head trainer at NXT. He was there, and his tag team partner at the time was Carl Anderson. You had Fergal Devitt, aka Finn Balor, who was there. There was a very few guys, and so New Japan was interested. So in Philadelphia 2011, or actually New York and Philadelphia, New Japan did a small East Coast invasion tour. MVP had already been in the company for some time. That was when they crowned their first Intercontinental Champion, who was MVP. They asked me to come to Philadelphia. And when I got to Philadelphia, it was kind of an interesting situation because all of a sudden, a lot of the people within New Japan I'd already met before, and they knew me, and they didn't realize they knew me until I showed up and they went, oh, we know you, because they'd met me when the guys had come to TNA at different times. Anytime, you know, they were in New York and with WWE, Tiger and Tori would always come to the shows and stuff. So the relationship was already there with guys, just nobody knew it until we were face to face. And then I was only supposed to be going over to New Japan for one event, and it was kind of to be my tryout moment. Once they realized who I was, in a sense of they knew me, not necessarily like who I was within wrestling, just as a person, all of a sudden it was like, hey, can you stay for an extra 2 weeks? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And like I said, luckily I did my part, did well in my initial match, and did well in the 2 extra weeks that I stayed over, and so on and so forth. And like they say, the rest is history. I've had an amazing, fun, best part of my career in Japan, you know, in the last 6 years.
And taking part in the G1 Climax, it was 2011, 12, and 13, I believe. I mean, that's got to be such an honor, especially, like you said, for a foreigner at that time. You had,
and 2004.
Albert there.
I did four.
There were four tours.
Yep.
So, I mean, how do they... I mean, that schedule, the G1 schedule, I mean, I know they say, you know, WWE guys are on the road 250, 300 days a year. The G1 schedule is really unlike any other schedule in professional wrestling. That I can't imagine the toll that takes on your body. And especially with such, you know, a strong physical style, the G1 has to be one of the most intense tournaments there are out there, period.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is the... regardless of professional wrestling anywhere else in the world, it is the best and number one singles tournament that exists. No other company puts on a better singles tournament than the G1 Climax. So as far as the grueling schedule, you know, it was kind of different back in 2011 and the 4 years that I was a part of it. It was still grueling, but it wasn't what it is today. Like today, now it's a month long event, you know, where they're having shows in so many different cities, and guys are, you know, they'll work G1 matches some nights, and then they'll work tag matches the other nights, kind of back and forth and so on and so forth. Back then, like, I remember the first tour I did, I think literally like every night was a G1 match, and then we all had like one specific complete night off where you just weren't booked, and you just weren't, either if we were on tour, you just hung out for the day at the venue. If we were in Tokyo and you weren't on the show and you didn't want to go to the show, you could just have the day off. It was grueling back then, but there weren't as many shows, and it wasn't like this month-long grind that it has become today. I think the 1 year when they decided to start expanding the tour, both so they could make more money off of it, obviously, but also to kind of give guys a break and break up the monotony or the hardness of the schedule and working singles matches every single night. And at that level, was, I want to say, my last year that I was part of it, because we literally did 9 shows in 11 days. And it was just, it was intense. Like, and that was the year that Goto got his jaw broke. Tenzon had a rib broke. So they both had to fall, you know, bow out of the tournament and stuff like that. So it's one of those things where they went, okay, this is too hard, too much, too fast. So we're going to expand it and try to give them breaks in between to help them along. But like I said, in the last couple of years, especially with the addition of the New Japan World, which has come along when Bushiroad, the company that bought New Japan, you know, it's become such a long, big event. You know, by the end of it, the guys are still just, they've been on buses and planes and trains, and they've wrestled everywhere they could in Japan. And all these shows are, especially the ones that are live on the New Japan World, which I think was pretty much every G1 event. So everything is in a bigger capacity. It was such a grind. Like this year was my first year getting to be at the final again, because Smith and I did our surprise run in, and just, you know, to see the guys. And you know that night it was just Kenny and Naito who were having the main event, which those two, oh my gosh, if you saw that match, was just insane. But you could just tell that everybody was just, they were so happy that it was done, you know, that they were finished for that tour, that it was like, okay, we can do tonight, we'll all bust our ass, but then we get a little bit of time off, thank goodness, you know, because it had been such a hard grind. So it was very different when I was there and a part of it for the 4 years that I got to be a part of it. And then, you know, we went away for those 2 years to Noah. And then in this last year, you know, myself getting injured and not having Smith in it and whatnot. So it's been 3 years since I've been a part of the G1, and it's changed drastically because of the New Japan World and the expansion into the U.S. market and things like that. So they both had their hard points, but it's a very different one these days, especially with being 19 shows over basically a month long period. It's crazy.
Having said that, this year at the finals, like you said, you and Harry Smith came back and you attacked the Gorilla of Destiny and War Machine. The Killer Elite Squad, did you know Harry beforehand, or was that just kind of the perfect meeting of two guys that formed a great tag team?
You know, I mean, the story of my tag team wrestling career has just kind of just been thrown together with guys, from me being put with Kid Cash way back in the TNA days and that working well, I did a time with Truth and Ron Truth Killings in TNA, and that was fun. And then obviously Jimmy Rave and so on and so forth. You know, Harry, or Davey Boy Smith Jr., he and I knew each other from WWE, because he was, you know, him and Tyson Kidd were together. They were tag champs back then. We worked some tours with them, you know, against them and stuff like that. But, you know, we didn't know each other. We just knew each other. Hey, man, what's up? Shake your hand. How you doing? Whatever. And that was about the extent of it, you know, as wrestling is a lot of times. I'd been with New Japan since June of 2011, and they brought him in, I want to say September 2012 is when they brought him in. Yeah, because then we won our first IWGP tag titles in October 2012. So I've been there, you know, a little over a year at that point, and they were wanting to bring Smith in. They told me that they were going to put us together as a tag team, and obviously he was being brought into Suzuki-Goon, which I'd already been a part of. You know, and as far as the Killer Elite Squad, we created the name. You know, we talked to each other and decided to come up with names, and talked to the booker and said, hey, this is what we'd like you to do. We know we're part of Suzuki Goon, but if we're going to be a tag team, we'd like to give the tag team its kind of its own identity within the group and so on. And they loved the idea. And Smith and I came up with, you know, KES, Killer Elite Squad. And, you know, we've worked really well together. And it's been a fun ride, you know, watching the growth and transition, you know, from how we've both changed in our styles and our way that we've worked together and stuff like that. It's been a lot of fun, man.
Yeah, and with the, you know, the tag team division in New Japan Pro Wrestling, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of big, bad guys out there. And so we have Destruction coming up on September 10th. It's War Machine versus Gorilla of Destiny versus you and Harry for the IWGP tag team titles. They just announced that this week. I mean, that is going to be the whole card. They have the Destruction here in Fukushima and in Hiroshima. That's, you know, those are some big matches that, like you said, are going to get a lot of press because of New Japan World. And now that they've added the English commentary in there, I think that's going to open up to a whole different world, especially since they expanded over to California. What do you see the future for New Japan? Do you think we're going to see a more consistent U.S. presence?
Oh, absolutely. I think the wrestling world has expanded so tremendously because of the internet. You know, the internet can be an evil place, but it can also be a very cool place for, you know, it's helped expand independent wrestling. New Japan, obviously having New Japan World and then they're on Access TV, it's helped open their market to a whole new audience that's in the States. You know, it's one of those things like I've been with the company since 2011, and it's kind of funny that because we had that 2 years that, you know, our group Suzuki Goon was, you know, loaned off to Pro Wrestling Noah, like us coming back, like there's people that haven't seen us, that in a sense don't know who the Killer Elite Squad are, although we have a history within New Japan. Like I said, we're two-time IWGP Tag Team Champions. We've worked two different Wrestle Kingdoms as the IWGP Champions. So we've been there, but just in the last couple years with the expansion in New Japan World and how much access has grown and the U.S. market has grown and the world market has grown, you know, they've expanded tremendously into the U.K. Environment and their relationship with Ring of Honor, which has, I think, been a tremendous thing for New Japan and Ring of Honor, you know, to help expand. Obviously, look at like guys like War Machine, a tag team that's former Ring of Honor tag team champions, you know, that made their name with Ring of Honor. They got on with New Japan because of that relationship and have exploded in Japan, have done extremely well. So to see that on both sides for talents that are, you know, that are both New Japan talents and Ring of Honor talents, and then being able to flourish because of those two, when you ask, are we going to see more consistency in the States? I think absolutely. You know, did you happen to see the Los Angeles G1 specials? Did you happen to see those?
Yes, we did. Sorry about that. Yeah, we saw both of those back to back. And the crowd for those shows, I mean, I really believe they could do, you know, 8, 10, 12,000 seat arena.
Yeah, you know, but that was the thing. For them, it was a testing ground. It was, we know that there's a U.S. market out there. We know that people are wanting to see us as far as New Japan goes, but it's a smart expansion, you know. So they basically, Korakuen Hall, which is a very famous wrestling arena in Japan, you know, their shows every weekend in that venue. You know, sometimes there'll be two or three shows a day, depending on different companies coming out. There'll be early, you know, morning to afternoon, an early afternoon show, and then the evening show sometimes. You know, three wrestling shows in the same building, all just in and out, bang, bang, bang. It's about a 2,100, 2,200 seat building, you know, at capacity. And that's kind of what they wanted, was something in the similar size range as Korakuen Hall, because they wanted to see how they would do and how the market would sell. And obviously with the speed that the tickets sold out, you know, when they initially put them online and for sale, was amazing to them, to the point where they put, you know, an extra 300 for each day, and those sold out like in 10 minutes, from my understanding. Because of that, because of how well it did and the reception they received at the shows, during the shows, and everything that just went so well with it, they absolutely have plans. You know, they already announced that they would be coming back in 2018. But that was a precursor, and the way it went so well, it absolutely opened their ideas and minds to doing so much more in the U.S. I know that they're planning on opening a dojo in Los Angeles. They're going to set up an office in Los Angeles. You know, it's something they haven't done in years. You know, Fertile Devitt and Shinsuke and all those guys were in one of the original L.A. dojos, but that closed down. Now they're reopening it in Los Angeles, kind of setting base in L.A. And so I think when they do something next time, they will reach out and see if they can get 5,000-8,000 people into a venue. And if that does well, then they'll expand from that. And if all of it goes well, I think they absolutely have plans on U.S. touring, kind of with their own U.S. touring brand of wrestlers, both American and Japanese, guys that will come over from Japan and spend, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks a month's time over here, kind of like we do when we go over to Japan and run a touring company, you know. But it's a slow process. They don't want to go too fast and overstep their boundaries and put themselves in a hole. They're trying to do it smartly. But I think it's absolutely something you're going to start seeing. And it's like that choo-choo train. Once it gets going, it's hard to stop. And I think that's where they're headed right now.
I think New Japan Pro Wrestling definitely gives an alternative to American wrestling fans, because a lot of American wrestling fans are not huge on the product that the WWE is putting out right now. So having that New Japan, you know, feel in America, I mean, you get the ratings, I know we're through the roof, and like you said, the ticket sales. So I think, you know, this is the time to strike, and I think they're doing everything the right way, like you said. And you mentioned a sellout. I know the Young Bucks merch is selling out at Hot Topic. When are we going to see the Killer Elite Squad shirts at Hot Topic?
You never know, man. I don't know. You know, I think that's something that they were able to create. I mean, you have to hats off to the Young Bucks, hats off to everything they've done to create their product that is them, you know, that has been in professional wrestling. They've made themselves by themselves a product in the business, you know, something that sells, whether they're on the independents, whether they're working New Japan, whether they're working Ring of Honor, wherever they're working, people want to see the Young Bucks, and they've done an amazing job of making themselves an invaluable product. And in part of that was creating this relationship with Hot Topic. The cool part to me is, you know, originally, and I think that's what originally planned was, it was just going to be the Young Bucks, but it's kind of cool to see that whoever garnered that deal expanded it to basically the Bullet Club stuff, you know, with, I know Cody has a shirt. I know Hangman Page has had a shirt. I know the Young Bucks obviously have a shirt. I don't know all the other ones, but I know that there's several different shirts, including the Young Bucks, obviously. So it's really cool to see what they've done. We're not in the Bullet Club. They are the Elite. We are Killer Elite. You know, it's a very different situation, but you never know, you know, as far as the expansion goes, and with what Hot Topic has seen, you know, as far as well as it's done, you know, Hot Topic may be wanting them to help reach out and bring in more product that's not just Bullet Club product, you know what I'm saying? But for now, it's theirs, yeah. And you have to, you know, like I said, you have to applaud them for everything they've done.
I think actually, now that you mention it, there is some infringement there. You got the Killer Elite Squad's been around a lot longer than the Elite, so I think maybe down the line that might be something you guys have to hash out.
Well, you never know, and obviously, and I've been the American Psycho for a lot longer than the American Nightmare has been around in New Japan. So that's something that Cody and I might have to have an in-ring conversation about.
It's definitely got all the makings. And if fans want to check it out, prowrestlingtees.com/Lance Hoyt. All of the Killer Elite Squad shirts are on there, and they are awesome. The Let's Get Crazy one happens to be my favorite. So nothing but the best of luck with those shirts. Now, do me a favor. Just tell all the fans where they can keep up with you. We can see what's happening at Destruction coming up. Where can fans get in contact with you?
You know, obviously my Twitter, at Lance Hoyt. My Facebook is Lance Hoyt. It's all public and open, so people can check it out. They don't have to, we don't have to be friends. They can see everything that I'm promoting and doing on there. My Instagram is Lance_Hoyt. You know, those are the three main ones that I use on my Twitter, my Facebook, and my Instagram. And then as far as New Japan goes, you know, the New Japan World, like you said, they've got their events coming up. We have three tag title matches on this next tour. I don't know the whole dates. I know you said the cards have been released, but I haven't seen them myself. But we have three tag title matches on this next tour. So you never know what's going to happen as far as this tag title is concerned. As far as we're concerned, we're going to win them the first night and then just keep them the rest of the time. So that's our plan. So that's where people can check it out. Hit me up on Twitter. Hit me up on Facebook. Hit me up on Instagram. Like I said, keep an eye out on New Japan World. It's only 999 yen, which is like $8.30. It's well worth it. Like you said, they've got English commentary for all the big shows now. You can watch them live if you're willing to wake up at whatever, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, depending on where you're at, or if they're archived. So you can just turn it on and watch it whenever you want. It's pretty much the exact same format as the WWE Network, only you're actually getting to watch New Japan Pro Wrestling on a total consistent basis. And then obviously Access TV, which airs Fridays at 7 o'clock. If you have Access TV, you'll start seeing more of our stuff as we start being on the product more and more. So it's a lot of cool things coming up. We get to reintroduce ourselves to the wrestling world in a sense, because again, it's expanded so much since we've been gone, that even though we have been a part of the company since, like I said, 2011, 2012, it's a rebirth. We're reborn, man.
Yeah, with the new, you know, the new expansion, the new eyes on the product, I'm really looking forward to seeing where New Japan Pro Wrestling goes and where the Killer Elite Squad goes. And Lance, we cannot thank you enough for your time. I appreciate you hanging out with us, talking to us, and giving us a little glimpse into what it's like over there over New Japan Pro Wrestling. So thank you very much, sir. We look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you having me on tonight.
Thank you, everybody. And that was Lance Archer, one half of the Killer Elite Squad, one half of the Rock and Rave Infection. And overall, just great guy. That was a fantastic interview. I love listening to that guy talk. He had some great stories.
Yeah, that was a lot of awesome stuff. I think I've got a lot of history, you know, between working in the TNA from the early phases of it and as it was kind of growing, working in WWE when it had the ECW programs, some developmental stuff. He was on SmackDown and then transitioning over into New Japan now, which is becoming a bigger, you know, a bigger company, more worldwide known company, expanding out to the U.S. and different things like you guys were talking about. So he's in a tag team. He's up for their world tag team titles. They're doing three rematches, triple threats in Japan at the Destruction Tour on the 10th, 16th, and 24th of September. So, you know, a lot of good stuff from him. This guy's got a lot of experience in the business, a lot of good stories to tell. So this was a really great interview.
I believe they're going to call those Hoss matches. You know, we have just six monsters and they're just beating the hell out of each other. I'm really looking forward to it. And man, like you said, so much history to be in the business that long in every major organization. And just what a great guy. It was a pleasure speaking with him. We got time for SummerSlam? I mean, emotion.
We do. I guess we were wrapping up the NXT, I guess. So real quick, just I know we went through all the matches in the final angle. What did you think of the show, you know, on our patented grading scale that's used across the
country? I'm going A-.
A-?
Yeah.
I got to go A, man. I don't really have any complaints about it. I mean, there could be an A+. That'd be like the perfect show. It was not the perfect show. There are no perfect shows, but it was pretty close to it.
Yeah, it was damn near. It was damn near perfect. The only issue I have is there wasn't enough Yano.
Yeah, there never is for you. Real quick, I know I mentioned the Meltzer ratings for the matches.
I cannot wait to hear it.
I just want to let you know what they were. Don't look.
Let's go, Daddy Meltzer. Come on, I'll read them off.
So the Andrade Almas versus Johnny Gargano match.
6 stars.
4.25 stars.
Oh, that's a little bit high for my liking. Okay.
Sanity versus the Authors of Pain, 3.75 stars.
What?
Wait for it. Aleister Black versus Hideo Itami. 4.25 stars.
What?
Asuka versus Ember Moon, 4.5 stars. Drew McIntyre versus Bobby Roode, 4.25 stars. This guy ate the show up, my friend.
So cover your ears. Everybody cover their ears. I'm going to curse.
No, there's no cursing.
Get the out of here. Are you kidding me?
Good Christian boys. You can't do that.
I censored in my ears. What?
Yeah.
I like the show, and I thought the show was solid.
He loved the show.
For all of you internet trolls that get on Daddy Meltzer about being a New Japan butt rider, that's a new word, let me tell you something. That man is trying to make up for 2 years of 7-star matches all in one night, because I don't think any of those ratings were legitimate. I think if anything, he undervalued the tag match and what do they call that? Who's that chef that sprinkles the salt? Salt Bay. Have you seen this?
No.
The video, they call him Salt Bay, and he holds his finger and he just sprinkles the salt on. There's a gif of Meltzer sprinkling this, but it's stars for the Kenny Omega match. I think he incredibly overstated a lot of those matches. Like, not, I mean, I thought everything was good, but I don't think anything was 4.5-star worthy, do you? Especially not the main event. The main event to me was the weakest match of all. And unless he loves
Bobby Roode, though. He does. I heard him on a recap, an like audio recap of the match, and like him and Brian Alvarez, who do Wrestling Observer Live, those shows, and he really likes Bobby Roode and the way that he works and the way that he builds matches. So apparently he's just a big Roode fan, so that might be the reason why he gave that match a higher rating than a lot of places elsewhere that I read. I think the Gargano match, that's the exact rating I've seen in like three different spots. That 4.25. Yeah, everyone I read seemed to give them that rating. But some people liked it better than others. The main event, it was kind of polarizing. I saw somebody give it like 2.5. I saw somebody else give it 3.75, and Meltzer gave it 4.25. So
I would give the main event 3 stars flat. It was now. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off. Is he including the post show angle? Because if you're going to include the post-show angle, I'm going to go eight stars.
I don't think that's
10 stars.
I don't think that's how it works.
1,000 yen.
So I don't think that's how it works. So
okay.
What
do we do? Do we go into SummerSlam? I mean, it's going to be a long show. How tired are you? You want to just go over it real quick? Tell me what to do, Joe.
We can just hit the key points, I think.
You don't want to touch on all 96 matches?
No, I don't want to talk about Big Cass and Big Show. I don't think we need to hit the pre-show. All the thing I'll say on the pre-show was, and I ended up watching it the next night because I did not see the pre-show before SummerSlam, the main card kicked off. I did watch all three matches, and the Usos and New Day match was very good as advertised from people that had watched it. Then don't be cheating looking at my Meltzer ratings. That's my gimmick, all right? I read the Meltzer ratings.
You want to be the Meltzer guy.
Meltzer
ratings. You could be the Meltzer ratings.
No, I have no idea. I just found this today.
I want you to read the Meltzer. All right. I will agree with you. I'll echo your sentiments. I think the Usos versus the New Day was a fantastic match. There were two questionable spots where the timing was off, but the match was actually so good that it didn't even matter. That match was fantastic, and the Usos versus New Day would have been the right match to kick off SummerSlam, not John Cena burying Baron Corbin, which I don't want to talk about. Do you want to talk about that?
You don't want to talk about Baron Corbin getting buried?
No, Baron Corbin sucks. Natalya beating Naomi by submission. Good for Natalya. If anybody in the women's division deserves the title for all that she's been through, Natalya deserves it. I'm a big fan of her.
Gonna get that glow crap off my TV.
Why don't you join the gorgeous ladies of wrestling and glow over there? Big Cass versus, this sucked so bad. This was different types of animal ass in one match.
Wow, that's.
Yeah, this is like 9 different types of ass.
And descriptive.
This was terrible. This was atrocious, terrible, god awful, served no purpose. Enzo baby oiling himself actually was kind of funny. I will give him that. I did enjoy that. That was a little funny.
You enjoyed Enzo.
You know what I mean.
I'm going to edit this podcast and cut that together. Because where you're just saying you enjoy Enzo oiling himself up.
You know what I meant. You know what? You're being a real putz right now. I enjoyed the gimmick.
That's mean-spirited.
Yeah.
And your words are hurtful. I think you should
do that. I hope they sting like a bumblebee's ass. Anyway.
A lot of ass comments for me tonight.
What
is that about?
It's been a long day. Listen, the payoff to the Big Cass, Big Show with Enzo in a shark cage match, with Enzo covers himself in baby oil, squeaks his body out of the cage, falls down, gets booted, Big Show gets booted, Cass gets the pin 1-2-3. Then they do a rematch the next night on Raw.
They did a rematch
of Enzo and Cass.
Enzo versus Cass, and Cass blew his knee out or whatever it is, and he's out for 6 to 9 months. So
in a bunch of malarkey street fight. Randy Orton versus Rusev was 10 seconds, and Randy Orton RKO'd him and won. Rusev attacked him quick before the bell rang. Bell rings, missed the boot, and how you doing, Rusev? Enjoy the unemployment line because apparently he asked for his release.
Allegedly
with Lana. That's the rumor on the street. The next match was Sasha Banks and Alexa Bliss. Any comments?
I mean, Sasha winning the title, I think, I don't know if we both predicted that. I know I think I mentioned it happening. I don't really know. They don't really have much of a direction here. The whole Bayley thing with her character and now how the crowd is kind of booing and reacting to her in a negative way, I think has really thrown off whatever potential plan they had for that title on Raw. So I really don't know where they're going with this whole thing. I think they're just going to obviously run with Banks and Bliss on Raw this coming Monday in a rematch. So we'll see if they continue to kind of play up Banks not being able to defend the championship when she wins it, or if they actually give her a win and let her have an extended run with the title. But it was a solid match, I thought. They worked hard. They gave him 13 minutes. It was fine. Not a classic or anything like that, but it was what it was.
The right thing to do would have been have Sasha Banks win the title, Bayley hug her, and then Bayley turn heel in the middle of Barclays, because it's the only way she would have gotten cheered for me. You don't like that?
Can't turn Bayley heel, bro.
They already turned her heel by killing her gimmick. I think this would have been the perfect opportunity to pull the trigger on that and have the inflatable, she could be like a female Doink. You come out pandering to the kids and you go to hug one kid and you body lock him and hit him the Bayley to belly over the rail. That's good booking. Bayley heel turn. Beating up 5 years.
You want this girl to squirt water out of a flower on her jacket? Is that what you want her to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, if we're talking about cutting different pieces and making, drops, I'm going to cut some of what you just said, just so you know.
Do you know how to? You don't know. Come on. Finn Balor defeated Bray Wyatt. Balor returned as the demon, which apparently is a thing now that they advertise ahead of time, somehow knowing that that's what he's going to do.
Oh, my God. Who the hell cares? I tried to do the exact, what do I call that? Flow of the drop, because I don't have the drop. But do you care about the demon?
No, I don't. I mean, I like Finn Balor. I do. I think, but Bray Wyatt is well past his expiration date, in my opinion. I don't have any interest in Bray Wyatt or his promos.
Like a bag of stale Canadian milk.
Yeah. They have that in a bag? They sell that in a bag in Canada?
It's all in Canadian. Yeah, they have milk in bags.
Oh, okay.
Stupid.
Sounds not efficient at
all. You ever try to pour milk out of a bag?
No.
It's like bags of sand. It just gets all over the place. There's no hook to it, so like it doesn't pour out
any milk. Is what you're saying.
Sandy, crusty Canadian milk. Speaking of Canadian milk, that's all I got.
Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins defeated Cesaro and Sheamus for the Raw Tag Team Championships. Probably on the main card, this was the first match that was really good, I think. And
it's good when you're 10 matches in the show.
Well, yeah, on the main card, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th match of 10 on the main card. The storyline leading up to it, I thought, was very effective. Crowd was into Ambrose and Rollins as a team. Very good match with two good good solid workers in Cesaro and Sheamus, and Ambrose and Rollins ended up winning the tag titles. I have no real issue with that. I mean, I like Cesaro and Sheamus as a team now. I think they developed really well. But Ambrose and Rollins are probably as over as they've been in a long time now that they're back together. So I think putting the titles on them is the right move.
Absolutely. Ambrose and Rollins were kind of toiling away in obscurity, and the crowd is huge for them. And I like the finisher, Seth Rollins as the Rainmaker into the V-trigger kind of deal. And then Ambrose hits the dirty deeds. I like the finish. What's the issue? Is it? What?
I don't know what a V-trigger. No, that's just a, yeah.
Oh, it's Kenny Omega's knee.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Why did...
That's not, I don't know what that is. That's not what he does.
Yeah, he does the wrist lock, Rainmaker-esque right. setup
yeah.
into the jumping knee.
Yeah. Does Kenny Omega do that regularly? Because I watched a bunch of matches and haven't seen him do it. I know he's claiming that he invented the move, but that's not...
No, he that's his move.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Anyway.
Like, the pedigree was Rollins' move, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, what we're saying here is Ambrose and Rollins, they have good chemistry, obviously, and these guys, they work, they definitely work really well together. And if you're wondering what that message was, it was just Lance saying, absolutely, thank you. That's all. I hope it's not the end of Cesaro and Sheamus, though. I think they have some staying power as a tag team, and I hope we'll see a rematch sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure they'll definitely do a rematch or two with these teams in the near future.
Underwhelming, to say the least. The next match, AJ Styles versus Kevin Owens. How many? This is the fourth time they wrestled. The third.
In general, or on pay per view?
On pay per view.
The third this year, I believe.
In like 6 months, right? It's been.
Yeah, I think they wrestled at Backlash and then
Extreme Rules?
Battleground and then SummerSlam.
And they've had a couple matches on SmackDown too, one-on-one matches.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're trying to put a square peg into a round hole here at this point. These guys are fantastic workers individually, but together they just don't have those blowaway matches that you'd expect from guys of this caliber talent. And plus the main focal point of this was Shane McMahon as a special guest referee. So AJ Styles wins the match. You saw a rematch the next night, which also ended with Shane McMahon serving as a special guest referee. So
I think at the very end, right, he ended up taking over.
Yeah, after Baron Corbin left. Yeah. So like, why couldn't you have just done that instead of having Shane as a referee? And then you did the same thing twice to me. Like, it wasn't really necessary. The rumor is it's going to be Kevin Owens and Shane McMahon wrestling at some point, which is any ideas on that match?
I think they're going to do something that it sounds like Hell in a Cell, I think, is their next pay-per-view. I don't know if you guys put that in the cell or not. My guess is that they probably would. So that's probably what they're building towards, to try to get big matches on that Hell in a Cell show, which is SmackDown's pay-per-view this year.
Okay. Jinder Mahal defeated Shinsuke Nakamura with help from the Singh brothers on the outside. They didn't actually touch Nakamura, but he grabbed him and he did get the Rust Exploder on one. Or I don't remember what happened. It was bad. This match was not good. The match itself was not good. That's all I can say about it. And the worst part was the finish. Jinder couldn't even lock in the Colossus. He didn't even lock it in correctly to finish the match, and it kind of was just like a headlock takedown.
That's like a full Nelson slam, isn't it?
Things like Cobra Clutch slam, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. He drives the guy from behind. I don't know. Yeah, it might be Cobra Clutch or full Nelson slam. We can look that up. But I think he hits that, and then he kind of slams him. It picks him up and slams him down.
Right, but if you watch the end of the match, he didn't do that. He couldn't get the overhook, so he just had him with one arm. And, it's a Cobra Clutch slam. So, yeah, he couldn't even, like, lock the move properly for the finish. And after all the wars that Nakamura's been in with Cena and with, you know, everybody in NXT, it's just a rough way to lose to Jinder Mahal. And there's, I don't think there's any heat left for Jinder at this point.
Well, you can blame your buddy Baron Corbin for that one, my friend. So.
Oh yeah, I heard that. Because Baron Corbin's bad attitude, Nakamura did not win the title, and Baron Corbin did not cash in on him. And I just read today that John Cena destroyed Baron Corbin in the back. So you gotta be
2 weeks ago, I think, at a SmackDown taping or something like that. He like B-rated him in front of like the other talent and writers and stuff like that.
More like D-rated him, am I right? Because he sucks. Okay, listen, it's rude to say somebody sucks. I don't think anybody actually sucks, but he's just not very good in the ring to me. And apparently he's got a poor attitude. So I'm thinking the writing's on the wall. Baron Corbin and Enzo could be a good tag team. They could be called like the Outsiders or something. The 2017. Oh, they could be the new Razor and Diesel, like the fake ones that came in. Give them like a gimmick that everybody's gonna hate, because people already hate them. It's a good idea. You can make them like the new Rougeau brothers.
That's a great team.
Right. Exactly. They are a great team, but Corbin and Enzo would ruin it, therefore causing hatred. Reverse psychology. Speaking of reverse psychology. Brock Lesnar, Roman Reigns, Samoa Joe, and Braun Strowman in an awesome Fatal 4 main event. It was a 20-minute and 45-second car crash with tables and stairs and chairs and everything. And Brock Lesnar got stretchered out after Strowman put him through two tables, and then he suplexed the table on him, right? Or he kind of pushed the announce table on him?
Yeah.
And everybody thought Brock Lesnar was going to be out of the match. We're going to have a new champion. Lo and behold, here comes your babyface back in, and he gets the pin on Roman Reigns for the F5. I know you love the match.
Yeah, it's a really good match. But, I mean, I think easily probably the best match on this show.
You think it was better than the tag match?
Yes.
Okay. That's all right.
Definitively.
You know, everybody looks for different things in matches. I thought it was probably the most enjoyable on the card. I think they could have done a lot more with this pay-per-view by doing a lot less. If you took off Cena, Corbin, Big Cass, and The Big Show, and Randy Orton and Rusev, and you put the opening three matches in place of those, you would have a 9 or 10 match card that's a lot easier to sit through than this was. As a whole, I thought it was a very, very rough show.
I mean, I don't think it was a terrible show, certainly. I think that there's a couple of matches that were good, and there's some that, you know, I think in general, the pay-per-view should not go beyond 3 hours. That's the way it always was for the most part when we were growing up, with the exception of like the 2-hour In Your House shows that they were there in the 90s. But, you know, they should really keep it to 3 hours. I mean, if you've got too many guys, you know, it's just, to me, the best angles and the best matches are the ones that get on the card. So if you have a card that you want to put 8 matches on, then you decide what the best and most important matches are, the ones that are and the biggest storylines, and those are the ones that get on the card. So you can eliminate ones that shouldn't be there, and they don't need to expand the show out to 4 hours just to try to fit everybody on it because it's SummerSlam or whatever the hell it is. So that's kind of part of the roughness of it. Like the Big Cass and Big Show thing had no business being on the show at all, really. The feud was dead on the air on Raw every week, and they decided to put it on this show. The match itself was 10 and a half minutes long, plus the Enzo promo before it that took a few minutes. It was like 15 to 20 minutes between entrances and everything else that really didn't need to be on the show at all. So I think they would really benefit from even the major shows, you know, cutting them down to make sure that they don't go beyond 3 hours. And, you know, I think that'll make some of these shows a little bit more enjoyable from start to finish rather than having kind of lulls in the action or gaps of you know, matches that aren't as good.
I, for my money, could have taken Balor and Wyatt off the show too. That could have been fine on a Raw branded pay-per-view, but I wouldn't put it on the co-branded pay-per-view, which features mostly title matches. So grade the show, buddy. I can't wait.
I'd probably go C+.
Okay. That's fair. I'm going D. D for damn, I sat through 2.5 hours.
So you're grading the whole thing from the pre-show all the way to the end?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, not the actual, the wrestling in the pre-show.
Right.
Yeah, I want to hear, bring it on. I want to hear your new segment, Marking with Meltzer.
You want all the ratings for everything?
Yeah, just real quick.
So the six-man tag with Mr. Raj versus Jason Jordan and the Hardys was 2 stars.
Fair.
Neville versus Tozawa, 3.5. Mm-hmm. Usos versus New Day, 4 stars.
Hold on. Usos versus New Day with 4 stars, and he gave Bobby Roode versus Galloway 4.25?
Correct.
You suck.
Cena versus Corbin, he gave 2.
Fair.
Natalya versus Naomi, he gave 3 stars.
Fair.
Cass versus Big Show, 1 star.
Can you go lower than 1 star?
You can. Okay. You can go to dud. You can go negative range. It's all out there.
This had negative written all over it.
Orton Rusev, no rating because it was only 10 seconds long. Banks versus Alexa Bliss, 3 stars.
Mm.
Balor versus Wyatt, 2.75 stars.
Fair.
Ambrose, Rollins, Cesaro, and Sheamus, 4 stars.
Fair.
Ready? AJ Styles versus Kevin Owens, 3.75 stars.
What?
Jinder Mahal versus Shinsuke Nakamura, 2.5 stars.
No.
And Brock Lesnar defeating Samoa Joe, Roman Reigns, and Braun Strowman, 4.75 stars.
What? Wow.
Funny thing is, I got, well, I don't want to mention that. But yeah, so it's.
They got what? No, say it. You got to say it now.
That's when it goes. The guy posted an article of all the star ratings for the NXT and SummerSlam shows, and this is just on a blog. And then at the bottom, it goes, obviously, he couldn't go full Monty on any matches because it didn't involve Kenny Omega. That was the real statement at the bottom. So,
tight.
Just throwing it out there.
Well, he went over an abundance on the NXT show. I don't think any matches were bad, but I just think he's overrating it slightly. And the AJ Styles, what do you think? I'm sorry, 3.5?
3.75. He gave the Styles.
Oh, God. Yeah. Would you give that three stars?
Three stars or that rating?
No, 3 stars. Would you give it 3?
I probably would have given it 3. That's probably what I would give.
I think 3 is being a little bit generous, but I would maybe give it 2.75. 3. I think 3.75 is an over-exaggeration.
I think 3.75 is a little high. It's probably a bit of an overrate. But
you think he was happy that the Young Bucks and Hangman Page won the titles, so maybe he was just feeling very generous this weekend?
Yeah.
You think Dave Meltzer is part of the new Hung Bucks?
I mean, listen, I know he's a big fan of those guys. They have a tribute to him by naming their finisher the Meltzer Driver. So
they have a great shirt that says Meltzer Driver Everybody. Mm. And I feel like Kyle actually asked me if I could come into the city with him tomorrow and Meltzer drive everybody at his job. I told him
it's a very specific request.
Yeah, I asked him what the problem was. He just said he hates his job. So I'm willing to do that for him. I got to work on my flexibility.
Form a stable. All right.
Yeah. This was the longest ever episode of the All Night Long Wrestling Podcast.
Sorry.
Yeah. Listen, if you're listening to this show right now, just let us know. I'll send you a free t-shirt, I think. It's not going to be an All Night Long Wrestling Podcast.
Okay, I was going to say, what t-shirt are you?
No, I'm going to steal it from a locker at the gym.
Okay.
And I'll send it to somebody.
That's cool.
Just let me know what size it is, and I'll follow the person wearing the shirt most closely resembling your body type. That's what I'm here for. I think I just admitted to a misdemeanor on the air. Speaking of admitting to misdemeanors on the air, I really got nothing for you. We really appreciate you guys hanging out with us the last hour and a half. We'd like to thank Lance Archer for hanging out with us and speaking to us and just, you know, talking to us about New Japan and all the stories and his entire career. He spent a lot of time with us, and, you know, we don't have a lot of money to pay these people. So thank you very much, Lance Archer. Please check out his Pro Wrestling Tees store, prowrestlingtees.com/Lance Hoyt. You can find us on Twitter, on Instagram, at All Night Long WP. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/AllNightLongWP. And don't forget, always check us out on Damage 365 as part of the Damage 365 Radio Network and on prowrestling.com and on the YouTube page at youtube.com. I think it's prowrestling.com. I don't know. Just search us. But we are everywhere. We appreciate you guys. For the Stallion, I'm the Enforcer. We are exhausted. I'm tapping out.